This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour. Five European Union member states call for a summit to discuss, quote, huge disparities in coronavirus vaccine rollout in the bloc. British police officer is charged with kidnapping and killing a missing woman in London, a case that has sparked a debate over violence against women in the UK. And Bolivia's former interim president is arrested in connection with the 2019 political crisis that forced the then-president Evo Morales to resign and flee the country. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Nis. Thanks for joining us. Austria, the Czech Republic, Slovenia, Bulgaria, and Latvia have called for a European Union summit to discuss what they called the unfair distribution of coronavirus vaccines. The five EU states have sent a letter to the bloc's top officials to complain about, quote, huge disparities in vaccine handouts. They say that deliveries of doses to member states are not being implemented on an equal basis. The letter notes that under the current distribution system, only some nations would reach herd immunity. The Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, has suggested that several EU states may have signed secret contracts with vaccine companies to receive more doses. Meanwhile, the pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca has announced a fresh shortfall in vaccine shipments to the EU. The company has cited production problems and export restrictions for the shortfall. Iran has reported 73 more coronavirus fatalities, raising the death toll to more than 61,000. The health ministry says more than 7,800 new infections have been registered since Thursday. That brings the overall caseload to over 1.7 million. 1.5 million people have managed to recover from the deadly disease. Iran implemented strict coronavirus measures in November of last year, which resulted in a relative decline in the number of deaths and infections. But the figures have been ascending since new cases of the UK variant were detected in several parts of the country. A British police officer has been charged with kidnapping and murdering a woman who was disappeared in South London earlier this month. Wayne Cousins was charged after the body of 33-year-old Sarah Everard was recovered in Kent County on Friday. The officer serving in the Metropolitan Police Department was arrested earlier this week in the same country where he lives in. Everard was last spotted on March 3rd, walking home alone. Police say an investigation is underway to find the details of the murder. Cousins is due to appear in a court to face charges on Saturday. The case has sparked widespread anger about the safety of women. Lawmakers have denounced the gender violence and paid tribute to more than 100 women killed over the past year in the UK. Britain reportedly plans to increase the number of its stockpiled nuclear warheads for the first time since the end of the Cold War. A report by The Guardian says a review of defense and foreign policy would see an increase of the number of warheads, which currently stands at 180. The review is set to be released next week. The last defense review in 2015 committed the UK to reducing the numbers of operationally available warheads to 120. The increase is set to be aimed at persuading the US to co-fund a replacement for UK nuclear weapons, also known as the Trident nuclear program. Britain has been heavily dependent on US technology to operate its nuclear weapons in the past 60 years. Journalist and author Marcus Papadopoulos says the UK government complains of not having sufficient money to tackle poverty while seeking to spend money to expand its nuclear arsenal.
Today in the UK, 14 million Britons live in poverty. 4 million British children live below the breadline. Yet, the British government finds the money when it laments at apparently not having sufficient money because of the impact of what is known as COVID-19, nonetheless, the British government finds the money to increase its nuclear deterrent. Despite all of that, British mainstream media is silent on the matter. The British media, if British media was actually both independent and free, would ask the British government, would ask 10 Downing Street, why it is that the British government claims not to have sufficient money, for example, for the health service or for the education system or to tackle poverty, but has money, and we're talking about hundreds of millions of pounds, to expand Britain's nuclear arsenal. So in my opinion, that is the main highlight of the decision of the British government to expand the UK's nuclear stockpile.
The United States is reportedly going ahead with a massive $100 billion program to upgrade and modernize its nuclear missiles. This despite President Joe Biden's pledge to review Washington's costly nuclear weapons program. How urgent is this plan for Washington, which claims to be supportive of nuclear nonproliferation?
The United States set to build a new nuclear missile dubbed Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, GBSD, under a program for modernizing its nuclear stockpile. The $100 billion missile is expected to replace nuclear missiles, which have been operational since the 1960s. The new nuclear weapon under development would be able to travel nearly 10,000 kilometers, carrying a warhead more than 20 times more powerful than the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. The U.S. Air Force is reportedly planning to order 600 of them. According to the U.S. Congressional Budget Office report, over the next decade, Washington will spend some $500 billion on its nuclear forces, which will translate into a whopping $1.5 to $2 trillion expenditure over the next 30 years.
There's no clear reason as to why the U.S. needs this hugely expensive modernization program, except that it has a lot of support in Congress, and the military-industrial complex always wants it. The U.S. Military machine is kind of a self-propelling mechanism. It just keeps, going on, getting bigger and bigger and spending more money, no one seems to know how to control it, even if they really want to control it.
Washington began its nuclear weapons modernization program under former U.S. President Barack Obama. His successor, former President Donald Trump, who made every effort to reverse Obama's legacy, embraced his stance on nuclear weapons. Trump doubled the number of America's low-yield nuclear weapons. In February 2020, the Pentagon said a new low-yield warhead was deployed on the USS Tennessee submarine patrolling in the Atlantic Ocean to deter, quote, potential adversaries like Russia.
The United States, whose nuclear arsenal is made up of nearly 6,000 warheads, is the only country in the world that has used nuclear weapons in combat. Recently, America has taken steps to reduce its accountability, one of the most notable instances of which was its withdrawal from the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia. Yet U.S. allies, including Saudi Arabia and Israel, are also enjoying leeway to pursue their nuclear programs with limited accountability, if at all.
The United States withdrew from the Cold War era Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty in April 2019, accusing Russia of violating the deal, something that Kremlin has denied. The INF Treaty, reached with the Soviet Union in 1987, banned land-based missiles with a range of between 500 to 5,500 kilometers. With the treaty out of the way, the U.S. tested new missiles and made plans to renew its nuclear weapons tests. The U.S. shares the unaccountability with its closest allies, including Saudi Arabia and Israel, whose nuclear programs have been repeatedly slammed as non-transparent. Israel, the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, has tightly withheld information about its nuclear weapons program. It's estimated to be keeping some 100 nuclear warheads in its arsenal. Turning a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency, the regime has so far refused, with the U.S. invariable support, to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, that is aimed at preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. In the meantime, Saudi Arabia, which is a member of the NPT, has so far declined requests from International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect its nuclear sites. Despite this, the IAEA chief Rafael Grossi said in September last year that he believed Riyadh is after a peaceful nuclear program. But the approach toward other countries, including Iran, has been different. The U.S. withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal with Tehran, dubbed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, despite the IAEA's several reports from inspections that showed that Iran had been in full compliance with international accord.
The whole bargain that was the basis for the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, was that the existing nuclear powers would wind down their nuclear arsenals in return for other countries not creating nuclear weapons of their own. And so the U.S. Has adhered to neither of those principles. Both legs of that policy are being violated constantly. And U.S. Nuclear policy is in disarray, just as U.S. foreign policy in general is in disarray.
U.S. President Joe Biden is yet to take measures that would show his administration is willing to put an end to the double standard that is threatening the security of not only the region, but the whole world.
Catalonia's new parliament has held its first session following a regional election which saw pro-independence parties win a majority. During the session, lawmakers picked a radical separatist for their speaker. Usai Kedri brings us a report from Catalonia.
The pro-independence majority in Catalonia's newly elected parliament has picked radical separatist Laura Borràs for speaker, paving the way for the election of a new coalition government within 2 weeks. The former culture minister, who is an ally of exiled ex-president Carles Puigdemont, set the tone for the upcoming legislature.
The legislature that starts today must be a watershed towards achieving independence of Catalonia, as expressed by more than half of the citizens of this region.
Borràs was stripped of her immunity as member of Spain's Congress last year after she was accused of misuse of public funds when she was in charge of the Institute of Catalan Letters.
She has always denied the charges, saying that she is being investigated because she is an outspoken separatist.
Putting up a challenge to Borràs's separatists are members of the far-right Vox, who made their way into Catalan politics for the first time in the 2021 vote. They have vowed to break the seemingly united separatists. However, a majority of lawmakers agreed to erect a cordon sanitaire around the populist party, which won 11 seats in the February election.
Vox will be barred from holding any position of power in the Bureau of Parliament, despite being eligible for one.
The far-right party leader in Catalonia vowed to fight back.
Vamos a hacer su peor pesadilla.
We'll be the worst nightmare, and we'll fight them on all fronts, in parliaments, in courts, and in society. We'll fight to regain this Catalonia they've hijacked.
The next stage for Catalan lawmakers is the election of a president for the region. Former Vice President Pere Aragonès from the Republican Left Party of Catalonia is the likely candidate. He's a firm believer in the independence of Catalonia from Spain, but unlike the Speaker of Parliament, he advocates a more moderate approach with the central government in Madrid.
With a speaker under investigation and a spectacular breakthrough for the far right, Catalonia's parliament is off to a rocky start. For now, the road ahead is clear for the pro-independence majority to form a government and get down to business. Except this time, the man at the helm in the Generalitat will be holding out an olive branch in one hand and the Estelada flag in the other. Cassai Kadri from Catalonia's parliament, Barcelona.
The European Parliament debate has been told that more than 100 million people in the EU live in poverty. Lawmakers say the social justice measures being pursued by the European Commission lack ambition. Jerome Hughes has more.
Social Rights Commissioner Nicolas Schmit has presented plans in the European Parliament to lift 15 million people living in the 27-nation EU out of poverty by 2030. Lawmakers, though, seem less than convinced.
Let us be honest, these are not new problems. We have to renew our approach and our methods if we are to succeed. The Commission must coordinate better with the Member States on social targets.
MEPs say poverty affects more than 100 million people in the EU. Apparently, the bloc's handling of the COVID-19 crisis is making matters worse due to the economic fallout.
President von der Leyen has accumulated disaster upon disaster. Millions of vaccines never showed up as promised. The EU is responsible, and a high price tag has been paid by so many citizens.
All that is required to ensure social justice is political will, it has been suggested.
Despite the fact that homelessness has increased by 70% in the last 10 years, we collectively show that if we want to, we can provide people with a home.
During the debate, lawmakers said there are too many poor quality jobs in the EU, too many pay cuts, too many people sleeping on the streets, too many words, and not enough action. According to experts, moves by EU nations to privatise essential services such as healthcare are impacting the poorest.
There is a problem behind, and in my understanding it is very much ideological, because this idea of less state, less public investment, less public infrastructure, this is now paying off in a negative sense.
We are told, due to three key reasons, economic uncertainty remains extremely high in the 19-country eurozone.
Persistently high rate of coronavirus infection, the spread of virus mutations, and the associated extension and tightening of containment measures.
In May, EU leaders are due to hold a social summit in Portugal. They will go there knowing that previous targets to reduce social inequality in the EU were not met. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Bolivia's former interim president, Jeanine Añez, has been arrested in connection with the 2019 political crisis that forced the then-president Evo Morales to resign and flee the country. In social media posts, a minister announced the apprehension of Añez and several ex-officials by police. An arrest warrant was issued after prosecutors said that she took part in a coup against Morales. The detainees faced terrorism, sedition, and conspiracy charges. Añez, a former senator, took over as interim leader after Morales fled the country amid military pressure and violent protests against his re-election. The interim authorities then tried to prosecute Morales and key members of his government, accusing them of voter fraud. However, Morales returned to the country after his party won election again in last October. The U.S. has designated five Chinese technology companies, including Huawei and ZTE, as a threat to its national security. The Federal Communications Commission said the list is aimed at preventing next-generation networks from using services that can pose a risk to the security and safety of Americans. The designation came under a 2019 law that was enacted to protect U.S. communication networks. The law required the FCC to identify foreign companies potentially posing threats to national security. Firms like Huawei and ZTE had been blacklisted previously under the same law. Huawei had challenged the U.S. move in court, but has now declined to comment on the new designation. New Zealand has held a commemoration ceremony to mark the second anniversary of deadly terrorist attacks on mosques in the city of Christchurch. Several hundred people, including the Prime Minister, attended the emotional remembrance service, which was also live-streamed. 51 worshippers were killed in two consecutive mass shootings at two mosques during Friday prayer in 2019. Both attacks were carried out by a single terrorist. Friends in Toronto white supremacists opened fire at the worshippers, live-streamed the carnage, and posted a racist manifesto online. The attacker had legally bought five assault weapons, including two semi-automatic rifles that he used in the massacre. He was arrested shortly afterwards and sentenced to life without parole. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Andrew Cuomo suffered a major blow on Sunday, 7th of March, in his attempt to stay as governor of New York in the face of allegations of sexual harassment and workplace bullying and a scandal over nursing home deaths under COVID-19. The majority leader of the state Senate and the Speaker of New York's Assembly, two of the most powerful Democrats in New York, said it was time for Andrew Cuomo to go. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Martin Pengelly and Amanda Holbert. The piece is titled, Cuomo Suffers Major Blow as Top New York Democrats Say Governor Must Go. Andrew Cuomo suffered a major blow on Sunday, 7th of March, in his attempt to stay as governor of New York in the face of allegations of sexual harassment and workplace bullying and a scandal over nursing home deaths under COVID. The majority leader of the state Senate and the Speaker of New York's Assembly, two of the most powerful Democrats in New York, said it was time for Andrew Cuomo to go. But the governor was not budging, telling reporters he would not quit and reportedly telling the state's Senate leader she would have to impeach him. We need to govern without daily distraction, the majority leader, Andrea Stewart-Cousins, said in her statement. For the good of the state, Governor Andrew Cuomo must resign. Assembly Speaker Carl Heasty backed her, calling the allegations disturbing and saying Cuomo should seriously consider whether he can effectively meet the needs of the people of New York. Andrew Cuomo said he would not resign because he was elected by the people and not by politicians, and the system depended on due process. I'm not going to resign because of the allegations, the governor said. The premise of resigning because of allegations is actually anti-democratic. Citing an anonymous source, the Associated Press reported that in a brief phone conversation before Andrew Cuomo spoke to reporters, the governor told Stewart-Cousins that he would have to be impeached if his opponents wanted him out of office. Five women have accused Cuomo of sexual harassment, accusations that he denies. On Saturday, the Washington Post published new claims of bullying. One former aide claimed Cuomo ran a systemic, intentional, hostile, toxic workplace environment. A Cuomo aide has rejected the accusations. Other lawmakers have called for Andrew Cuomo to quit over allegations that his administration misled the public about coronavirus fatalities in nursing homes in New York State. On Sunday, 7th of March, prominent national Democrats, including the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who is from New York, and the Governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, expressed support for the women who allege harassment and for an investigation run by the New York Attorney General, Letitia James. The majority leader of the state Senate in New York, Andrea Stewart-Cousins, went further. Every day there is another account that is drawing away from the business of government, she said. We have allegations about sexual harassment, a toxic work environment, and loss of credibility surrounding the COVID-19 nursing home data, and questions about the construction of a major infrastructure project in New York. New York is still in the midst of this pandemic and is still facing the societal health and economic impacts of it. We need to govern without daily distraction for the good of the state, and Governor Andrew Cuomo must resign. Like other senior Democrats, the Governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, stopped short of saying that Cuomo should resign, despite comparisons to recent cases in which powerful men, among them the former Minnesota Senator Al Franken, were swiftly forced to step down. The Governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, said, I think the allegations here are very serious, and I do think that an impartial, thorough, independent investigation is merited and appropriate. And if the allegations are accurate and true, I think we have to take action. Last year, Gretchen Whitmer was one of the many prominent Democrats to back Joe Biden when he denied an accusation, telling CNN, "Just because you're a survivor doesn't mean that every claim is equal. It means we give them the ability to make their case and then to make a judgment that is informed." Earlier this week, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo apologized for behaving in a way that he said he now realized upset women. "I understand sensitivities have changed," Cuomo said. He added, "Behavior has changed. I get it, and I'm going to learn from it."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
الله هو ذا الرحمن الله هو ذا المنان.
لا إله إلا الله.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate and the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all the messengers of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and especially the last of them, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his progeny, and those companions who really followed their path. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to another program of questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. I'm your host, Sayyid Ayman Rizvi, and today we have a guest scholar, Mr. Mohsin Naqvi, with us here in our studio. Assalamu alaikum, Mr. Mohsin Naqvi, and welcome to our studio.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Today our question is related to our last imam somehow. So the question is, who is a real muntadir? I think what is meant here is to, you know the real qualities or traits of a person who is waiting for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, there are many questions that raise in the minds of people. For example, who are the waiters of the Imam, or who you are waiting for? What to expect, and how do we know that we are the waiters of the Imam? We are waiting for the Imam. These are some beautiful questions that the lovers of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam often ask themselves. And when they ask these questions, then they refer to those qualities which you just referred in the question, that what are the qualities of a person who is waiting for the Imam of the time, and what qualities he should have. In short, it can be said that the real muntadhir, or the waiter, is the one whose movements and residences indicates waiting, that he's really waiting. For example, if someone is expecting some guests in the house, they're waiting for them.
Yes.
In a way that they clean the house. If it's a dinner, so they cook food, they make everything ready for them, the best place to sit and all those things. And when they come, they welcome them.
Sure.
They take them to the place where they got ready, and then they serve them with the best things. They even dress well because the guests are coming. So
exactly.
These are the real waiters.
Yeah.
When we're talking about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, we need to see that, are we waiting every movement for him? Because anytime he can announce that an al-Mahdi, and obviously he can reappear. And on top of that, is our actions and our residences are according to what he is, basically what he desires to be like when he comes? Are we ready for him? For example, if he's coming, is our deeds, we can say, in a way enough ready so that we can face Imam of the time. So these are the pretty, these are some questions and these are some things that, some qualities that we need to have. If I can categorize the, we can say like the qualities of a waiter,
yes,
of a muntadir, the very first thing is that he should have the ma'rifah of Imam. Mm-hmm. That's the very first thing. Mm-hmm. Ma'rifah means knowing Imam. When we talk about the knowing of Imam, it can be divided into two different categories. One is historically knowing Imam. Mm-hmm. The second is knowing the status of the Imam. Like, okay, who is Imam? Who do we call Imam? Historically, we should know that he is the 12th Imam. He was born in, for example, 250 century, like Islamic history, Hijri, right, we can say. And 251, he was born. And he is the son of Imam Hassan Askari. All those historical data that we have. And it's been more than 1,000 years that he is in occultation. He had, for example, four successors after him, like Na'ibin, representatives, we can say. And after that, the Maraji of the time, the Fuqaha at this time, are the representative of the Imam. So these are the historical background, the knowing, okay, about the Imam. Generally, our public have this kind of information.
Yeah.
They only know about Imam historically. But what about the status of the Imam? When we talk about the maqam or the status of the Imam, we should realize that he is the Imam. And Imam is the one that Allah, Imam is the one that about whom Prophet has said that man mata wa lam ya'rif imama zamanihi mata mitatan jahiliyah.
Okay.
Whoever dies without knowing about his Imam of the time, he has died as a jahil, as an ignorant.
So basically you mean that the status of Imam as from the theological perspective.
Theological perspective, yes. We should know about his real status, of the real status of the Imam. And if someone does not know about his Imam and he dies, obviously he has died as an ignorant person. And obviously for the ignorance, obviously there are different, we can say like places in hereafter. So this is the very first thing, that we need to have the ma'rifah of Imam, that if Imam is infallible, for example, if he is infallible on our deeds on the nights of Qadr, they are presented to the Imam, and if my deeds are good or bad, everything is in front of the Imam, because he is the hujjah, he is the authority of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on this earth. And we also have hadith that if there is no hujjah or authority of Allah on the earth, the universe will disperse. Mm-hmm. There will be Qiyamah. There will be the judgment day.
Without his presence.
Without his presence. So basically he is present. Because of his presence, everything is on its place. Everything is running.
Yes.
So this is the first part, that we need to have the ma'rifah. The second thing, once we get the ma'rifah of Imam, once we know about the Imam, about his status, the theological status, we can say, the real status that has been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, once we know that Allah has appointed him as an authority and we have to follow, we need to follow him. The way we were following the prophets, we need to follow him. The second step comes where we need to love him. Muhabbat, hub. قُلْ لَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عَلَيْهِ أَجْرًا إِلَّا الْمَوَدَّةَ فِي الْقُرْبَى. We need to have mawadda, because the in Islam, the we can say the reward of accepting Islam or this guidance that we are getting in free from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala,
yes,
which we got from the Prophet as well, this guidance that we have, we did not pay anything. And Allah has said to his Prophet that, tell these people that if they want to give reward, if they want to pay back for what you have said to them, what you have taught to them, the guidance that we have given to them, it is the mawaddat of qurba,
mm-hmm,
the love of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi mm-hmm salam. And Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is the part of Ahlul Bayt. He is from the Qurbah. So we must love him, and it is necessary. If someone does not necessarily love Imam, then he is not paying back for what he have got from Islam,
mm-hmm,
the guidance that he had. And obviously, there is a hadith also. I think we mentioned it in one of the previous programs, that the night when the Prophet ﷺ went on Mi'raj, And when he was coming back, he saw 12 lights. And he asked Jibreel that, who are these lights? So the Jibreel said, these are your successors. Awaluhum Ali, like the first is Imam Ali, and the last is Qa'im. Qa'im means Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And the Qa'im is the one who muhallilu. Then the Prophet, then it was said like the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said to the Prophet that, oh Prophet, remember that the Qa'im is the one muhallilu halali wa muharrimu harami. He is the one that when he comes, he will turn back my halal to halal. And he will turn back my haram to haram. In today's world, where we are waiting for Imam Mahdi, don't we see that the things which were haram at the time of the Prophet or in the real Islam, the Muhammadan Islam, the things which were haram are allowable today? For example, yes. Riba, interest that we have in the banks.
Yes.
There are many other examples we can see. You know, people easily break their fast. In the month of Ramadan, very easily people do not fast. Without having any kind of, you know, kind of burden on their hearts or having like shaming for such an activity. They easily do these things. So Al-Qa'im is the one who will turn back people to the real Islam, the Muhammadan Islam. So the hub, the love of Imam is very necessary, because when you love him, you try to become someone who looks like him. You know, if I can just give an example, a general example, generally we see like, you know, when there are two couples who love each other, for example, a boy loves a girl, and if he knows that this girl, for example, who he loves, she does not like long hairs, she does not like jeans, she does not like her, we can say like the spouse or the one who is in relation with her, she does not like him to smoke. This boy will never smoke, will never wear jeans, will never do anything that hurts her. When we say we love Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, we need to see that our actions does our actions hurt Imam or not? With which actions Imam will become happy from us, and which actions will take us away from the Imam. So this is very important, the aspect of the love, because love is not just saying like, I love that person and I like that person. It's not all about that. You need to show, we need to show in our actions that we really love Imam of the time. So this loving aspect is very important. And obviously when we love someone, we make that person, we look at that person as a role model. And the way he says, the way he reacts, the way he speaks, obviously we try to follow him. If Imam speaks in a Quranic language, we must know about the Quran. What does Quran say? We, I don't know, many years have gone, obviously, some of have seen like 50 years of their life, some of have seen like 30 years of their life. But in these years that we have spent in this world, we have never read the translation of Quran once. So how can we like expect to be the true waiters of the Imam, the true muntazir of the Imam, when we even don't know about the when we don't know about the teachings of the Quran?
So just to make sure that our listeners don't get lost, you know, we just can you sum up all those important points, starting from the preparation and then move forward to knowing the Imam?
Well, we just mentioned two things basically. In order to have them, in order to be the true Vader or the Muntazir of Imam, the first one was to have the knowledge of Imam, to know about Imam historically, and we know him. We should know about his status as well. Spiritually, we should also know.
Exactly.
There is the historical perspective. There is a spiritual perspective, and the third thing was obviously the love of Imam. We must love him. This is very necessary, because it is wajib. It is according to the Quran as well. On top of that, we know that there is a hadith. We have a hadith also that annasu ala dini mulukihim. The people are following the religion of their chiefs. So when we say we love Imam Mahdi, when we say we are the follower of Imam Mahdi, obviously we are trying to be someone who who looks like him, who are the following his, who are following the footsteps of Imam Mahdi. And it is the duty of Imam and the prophets, obviously, to take us towards the perfection. So if we follow the Imam, if we love Imam, we will be following the footsteps of the Imam.
Thank you very much, Brother Mohsen Naqvi. That was a very important question you answered. And again, we wish for your prosperity and success in this life and in the next world. Many thanks to our dear listeners, and may Allah bless you all. Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
إن في الجنة نهر اللبن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن إن في الجنة نهرا اللبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شميحا.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Republican governors are increasingly ordering schools to bring young children back into classrooms. Their demands bolstered by declining coronavirus cases and calls from federal health experts and President Joe Biden to reopen schools. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Nicholas Fogel Burrows. The piece is titled, Republican Governors Are Ordering Schools to Reopen, Buoyed by Declining Cases and CDC Advice. Stay with us for more of Nicholas Fogel Burrows' article. Republican governors are increasingly ordering schools to bring young children back into classrooms, their demands bolstered by declining coronavirus cases and calls from federal health experts and President Joe Biden to reopen schools. On Friday, 5th of March, the Massachusetts School Board gave the state's education commissioner the power to force school districts to bring students back, a dramatic step that allows the commissioner to override local school boards. Earlier this week, Governor Doug Ducey of Arizona ordered all elementary schools and many middle and high schools to offer in-classroom instruction by 15th of March. A law signed by Governor Kim Reynolds of Iowa went into effect last month that also requires schools to offer full-time classroom instruction. As President Joe Biden has embarked on an aggressive effort to encourage in-person learning, governors have shown that they're increasingly willing to make unilateral decisions about reopening schools, nearly a year after many schools were first shut down. There is no substitute for in-person learning, especially for younger students, students with disabilities, and English learners. Jeffrey Riley, the Massachusetts Education Commissioner, said in a letter to the State Board this week, adding that about 300,000 students in the state were attending schools that provided only remote instruction. Massachusetts, Arizona, and Iowa joined at least four other states with Republican governors, including Texas and Florida, where state officials have demanded that schools offer in-classroom instruction for at least some grades. In many cases, orders that schools reopen have come over the objections of teaching unions, some of whom have argued that their members must be vaccinated before risking exposure in school buildings. President Joe Biden said this week that all teachers should receive at least one shot of a vaccine by the end of the month. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, has recommended that elementary schools open if they follow precautions, and its guidance says that even where transmission is high, elementary schools can reopen safely by implementing strict safety measures. Among school children of all ages, though, only about 4% live in counties where transmission is low enough for schools to safely reopen without additional restrictions. An opinion poll last month from Pew Research found that about 59% of adults believe schools should wait to reopen until teachers have had a chance to get vaccinated. The percentage was even higher among non-white adults, and 80% of black adults said schools should wait until teachers can get vaccinated, the highest of any racial group. People who made less money and Democrats were also more likely to say that schools should wait. In Massachusetts, elementary school students will most likely return to classrooms full-time next month, said Mr. Riley, the education commissioner. Riley vowed to continue working closely with medical experts when making decisions about reopening schools. In a limited set of circumstances, he said, schools could get waivers allowing them to reopen more slowly, and parents would be able to choose to keep their children at home and learning remotely throughout the end of this school year. But Mr. Riley said at the meeting of the State Board, whose members are appointed by Governor Charlie Baker, that next year parents will need a medical exemption to keep their children out of classrooms, the Boston Globe reported. At this point, with the robust mitigation strategies we have in place and all the data and evidence we have in hand, he said, it is time to begin the process of returning even more students to classrooms. while a group of parents urged their children to burn face masks on the steps of the Idaho state capitol on Saturday, 6th of March, in a state that has never had a statewide face mask mandate. "Destroy them, feed them to the fire. We don't want them in our world anymore," young children are heard shouting as they grab handfuls of surgical and cloth masks and toss them into a barrel of flames. Adults in the background cheer them on. Idaho Governor Brad Little, a Republican, has resisted a face mask mandate in Idaho despite research showing mask mandates are linked to fewer infections and COVID-19 deaths in counties across the United States. Conservative lawmakers in the state have nonetheless pushed legislation banning any such measures. The demonstrations were in part organized by Dar Moon, the husband of Dorothy Moon, an Idaho state representative. Dorothy Moon, along with another state representative, Heather Scott, called the demonstrations a grassroots project that we have become aware of and fully support. Dorothy Moon claims that the state has a low caseload that doesn't justify protective measures. A total of 1,880 people in Idaho have died from the coronavirus, according to a New York Times database.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters 7300 kHz for the Indian subcontinent and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. In continuing and hopefully, inshallah, very soon completing the profound tradition of Imam Kadhim alayhi salam on the intellect. And we've gone through many stages in this tradition. We have reached the 31st section of this tradition. It's a very long section. So hopefully, inshallah, we will try and complete it in this segment of Hadith of the Day. Or maybe we will split it into two. In this section, the Imam mentions three traditions from three other Imams regarding the intellect and regarding the traits of one who has intellect. Very beautiful. As we saw that the Imam uses the Quran, the Imam then uses his own initiative at certain places, but this is his own explanation. And then in order to emphasize his own point, he's bringing traditions from other Imams as well. Very beautiful tradition in that regard. So the Imam in the first segment of this section, he mentions a tradition from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So the Imam says, "O Hisham, the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam used to say, among the indicators that a person has a strong intellect is that he has the following three traits. He answers only when he is asked. He speaks only when others are unable to speak." That is, maybe a person, you know, is not able to answer a specific question, or, you know, he doesn't have the ability to speak at a particular moment in time. He advises in the best interest of the recipient of his advice. These are the three main qualities here. He in whom not one of these three traits is found is a fool. So at least a person should have one of these three, that he only speaks when he is spoken to, basically. Or he speaks when other people are unable to give a suitable answer or suitable input to a particular problem or a particular issue. And when he advises somebody, he does not take his own personal interest into that by saying, "Oh, if I advise this person, I might get something back in return. Or I advise him in such a way that I have some benefit." No. His advice to this person is solely for the benefit of that person who has sought his advice because he feels that this person is an individual who can help him. So this is the three traits that Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib has mentioned in this section of the tradition from Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. And the Imam at the end says that if you don't have at least one of these three, you are surely a fool. So inshallah, we'll continue with this in our next section. Until then, inshallah, walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The debate.